I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet Afa Michael Weaver and the first of several artists' takes on the catastrophe in Haiti. It's not news after 2 months, and it's not news analysis either. Rather, these are stabs at fitting the disaster story into a context between history and heart. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one's with a man who worked 15 years in steel factories in his hometown of Baltimore, the world of The Wire on HBO, before he got his college degree and decided he was a poet after all. Tell us more, Michael, before you start, about where you're coming from, so to speak, in addressing the catastrophe in Haiti.
I'm coming from popular knowledge around among black people about the significance and the position of Haiti, and which is that we generally understand that Haiti's position is a matter of being punished for speaking back, for daring to be rebellious. There are all kinds of complexities around the history of Haiti, but it goes back to the original problem presented to the American government of how to deal with the first successful slave rebellion in the Western Hemisphere, and to keep that information and that inspiration away from black Americans. It haunted Jefferson. It framed his national policy, and remnants of that national policy are still present. Jefferson came to a final conclusion that he hoped that the expansion of America's economy and national policy beyond its own borders will somehow compensate for the contradictions in the democratic ideal. And that way, he allowed himself to use Haiti as part of his strategy for buying Louisiana, making the Louisiana Purchase. So Haiti's situation begins there. And as black people, those of us who know and are aware of Haiti's situation, historically, we understand that. So this earthquake seemed to be another in a long list of problems. So I just had this kind of sad image of being punished for talking back.
Stick with the history for a moment. Haiti, in effect, rose up Toussaint Louverture and beat Napoleon, in simple terms. Within months, Jefferson was buying Louisiana from the same Napoleon. Connect the dots.
When I was writing the poem, I went to the Library of Congress site and began researching, reading some of the letters that Jefferson wrote, trying to position himself in the best position so that the outcome of the whole situation would be the purchase. And initially, he supported the rebels in Haiti, but then he withdrew his support, understanding that would be a problem. And I don't know all of the details historically of how that transition happened, but Napoleon was also thinking that the sale of the Louisiana Territory would position the United States against his opponent, meaning England. One of the quotes that is attributed to Napoleon Bonaparte is that this will forever position the United States a few notches above the United Kingdom or England. Great Britain would not be able to recover from that. I imagine that Napoleon thought that he was giving it to England by selling Louisiana. I imagine withdrawing his initial support from the Haitian rebellion gave him some favor in Paris. So it's a complicated thing, and Jefferson was never able to free his own slaves because he was always in debt. However, he left his will. In his will, he positioned it such that they could be freed eventually, but he was always in debt. And so having his children and with Sally Hemings being related to his, his first wife, and it was just a complicated but very typical American situation. Maybe I should read Port-au-Prince, the Haitian poem.
Your poem, please.
Port-au-Prince, with the epigraph from St. Francis of Assisi, "Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. If the sky were to crack, the floor of heaven would be pearl white, a bed of ice after snow in Montreal, asylum from Port-au-Prince, the children under sheets, stiff and undone, near cement walls filled with sand on the bottom stoops of Mary, Blessed Mother Erzuli. Complex chants of a soul torn from Ile Ife, in the rubric of the crucifix planted on shores of empires. The seam of the spirit tears in earthquakes, ripping the cloth of the breath, suspending every wish you had in that single moment, the wet mess of your heart suddenly slapping the tiny plan of earth growing from the earth, some alien presence driving the real thing. The evil of the Enlightenment, husbandry of farmers ranking goats with black children, ledgers for the wealth of banks, investments, hedge funds, blackberries, joys we hold on to, like the monstrous Costcos on the hill, twisting the roots of our hearts, nowhere to run, to scream in the coming apart. Human bodies, slapped inside human bodies, pierced with jagged things, rocks and glass, zombies, the mute saints, pious and solemn. The French language humming to itself, Les nègres ne sont pas français. Writing a letter, plotting to buy Louisiana, the pen of Jefferson moves to contain what cannot be contained. Collapsed buildings, family photographs lying on broken bodies, sticking their tongues out in the rubble, reporters walking by with microphones, selling news as if it were cheese and bread.
Tell us how you wrote that, and when.
I was in Clarksville, Tennessee, and at the end of February, and they had a snow and ice storm in Tennessee, and so the event that I went down for had to be postponed. So there I was with time in my room, and I started working on the poem. And I contacted a friend of mine who's Haitian, Danielle George, to ask her some questions and to show her a draft of the poem. And I hammered it out that weekend. I've been through quite a few earthquakes living in Taiwan off and on, so I know how it feels to be in an earthquake. It's as if everything turns to vapor for that little bit of time, and you feel like your molecules are being pulled apart. And you feel also that even if you were to jump off the earth, you could not escape the feel of that. And it's like coming apart, literally coming apart for the time of the earthquake. And there's so many in Taiwan, the tremors and so on, that you have to learn how to live with them. They're sliders and they're jumpers, they call them, you know.
Is there more you want to say about that poem or that I should ask you?
I wanted to say so much in the poem, and originally I had more references, but I pulled some of them out that I didn't want to make it an encyclopedic poem where you had to have references to figure some things out. But Erzuli is sort of a patron mother in Vodun, and I didn't want to get off into something too esoteric for the general reader, you know. But so I left it where it was. Ile Ife, I thought, also was enough of a reference that might trick some people that, not knowing anything about the Yoruba religion in Nigeria, would not understand Ile Ife. So,
translate it.
Ile Ife can be described as the holy city in religious consciousness, in that religious tradition from West Africa, from Nigeria, what we call Nigeria, the Yoruba, sacred city, sacred place.
Michael, your history in Haiti goes way back before the earthquake. Take us back both to the people as well as the nature, and then power and politics. Your own interest, your own reading.
I would be venturing into the realm of the pretentious if I go beyond my own reading knowledge. I know Haiti through my Haitian friends. For example, the reference to Montreal comes from conversations with people from the Haitian community here in Boston who've told me how much they love Montreal, especially when it snows, you know. And so the image of coming from a climate that's more tropical and then loving Montreal in the beginning of the poem, that gave me that setting, you know, the opposite, the ice and the snow as opposed to the warmth and the more tropical climate in Haiti. And then also the contrast between Catholicism and then the Vaudun. The French were a kind of laissez-faire colonizer, and so the Africans were allowed to do more of their own carryover in terms of their religion from wherever they came in West Africa, as opposed to the British, who didn't think that was such a good idea. So in the United States, it was more of the British kind of policy towards keeping blacks from practicing cultural things from the continent. But in the Caribbean, it was more free. You could do that. And so that's the ethos of my knowledge about the place. And I've been to Jamaica once, but I've been to China and Taiwan several times. But I've not been to Haiti. But having traveled in Taiwan, lived there through earthquakes, I thought, oh, I know how an earthquake feels. And so my knowledge is gathered that way. You know? In terms of power, I think many black people, especially those of us who, as I said, have a knowledge of Haiti, we have an admiration for their resilience and their historical speaking back. Talking back is something that you're not supposed to do, you know. I'm reminded of this very nice essay written by the poet Harriet Mullen. Harriet wrote an essay about Harriet Jacobs' slave autobiography, Linda Brent, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And the title of Harriet's essay is Runaway Tongue, which is one of the quotes from the text itself. You know, Linda Brent is owned by Dr. Flint. And I teach this narrative, so it's a little bit accessible, even given the fact I'm almost 60 years old. But he says to her, he says, damn you and your runaway tongue, you know. You're not supposed to talk back. Among ourselves, even today, African Americans, we joke sometimes, oh, you better not talk back, you won't get such and such, you know. So we have that admiration for Haiti for talking back.
What else would you like to read us for the context?
If I can contrast that a bit and read the poem for Lucille Clifton.
Please.
And this poem is entitled Tuna Fish. Every day, tuna fish, in every conceivable manner, with tomatoes that leaked and made the bread soggy, with lettuce my mother tore in odd shapes that hung like ornaments from my mouth in the cafeteria, the high court. I had tuna on toast toasted lightly that was death cold at noon, on toast toasted darkly that crumbled like old ruins just when I was in front of LaRue Ash. She always wanted to kiss me long before I knew why she was so proud of the French in her name. Tuna in wax paper that tore and fell on the floor. Tuna in aluminum foil shaped like flying saucers that we threw at each other in assassination attempts. Tuna from brand names, star-kissed that always rejected, Hip Charlie in the sunglasses, Bumblebee with his oxymoron soul of insects and fish. Tuna made the day before, which seemed to smell truly like dead fish, the dead fish killed by pollution and washed up like rejected never-to-bees, the dead fish of hot sun. And nothing was so obviously poor as eating this when other kids had hot spaghetti from the kitchen where women like my mother labored over shiny pots and steam. Nothing was so distinctly humble as munching tuna and mayo when LaRue Ash mounted the bench of the table like the acrobat she was and asked aggressively for a kiss. I sat as stupid as a confused cat, blinked, masticated the sea's journeyman, bemoaned my banal lunch, but dreaded the deeper pit of despair, tuna's alter ego, bologna. I knew full well and grievously that LaRue could never come to view bologna as romantic. I knew, perhaps unconsciously, that few meats are as seductive as fish. I was driving Lucille Clifton to Washington, D.C. She was reading at the Martin Luther King Library. It must have been 1976 or 77. And she said to me, she said, I was 25 or 26 at the time. She said, Michael, you're a big man now. I can tell you grown-up stories. So she told me an X-rated story, you know, on the way driving down to the... And I said, thank you, Lucille. I'm grown up now. I can hear grown-up stories. So I wrote that poem for her.
Michael, you bring up the African-American perspective on Haiti that we don't know, and I'd love you to... What does the African-American street corner have to say about all this, including the earthquake, including the history, including the rescue efforts, the hospitals, the kind of heroic rush to do something and all that. And what's the line on in the neighborhood?
Well, I live in Somerville, which is a long way from East Baltimore, but I think Kalamu Yasalam. Kalamu lives in New Orleans, and he was in Haiti during the earthquake, and he posted photographs and so on. But he emphasized the point that life goes on and that black people survive and they persist in a blues kind of way. I'm thinking about Ralph Ellison now and his definition of the blues. He reviewed Richard Wright's Black Boy and wrote what I think is one of the quintessential descriptions of the blues. And it's about the resilience and dignity in the face of hardship. I think that African Americans, and I have not actually talked to anyone about this, but the conversation I would like to have when I get the opportunity is how much they think that this is the time when President Obama can make a turnaround in the policy toward Haiti to finally do something that sets in motion some things that will address the problems that were created by misdeeds in American policy for a long, long time. I did talk to someone who's Haitian, and we said to each other, well, the Marines are coming back again, you know, and so the presence of the Marines in Haiti is something that has happened before.
Where would President Obama begin? But where also, though, would President Obama, with his imagination, his literary skill, where would he take a new understanding, you know, if you had a magic wand?
If I could will it, there would be a magic wand that would reverse or stop some of the really harmful effects of globalization. And I think now is the time to make some very wise and crucial decisions about the ability of corporations to determine national policy. I think there needs to be more intervention than we already have. I can't presume to tell that man how to do his job. I wouldn't be that audacious. If a magic wand could be waved, it would have to begin to undo what David Davis, who's a historian from Yale University, describes as the very tragic psychological inversion where black people have been made to be a problem. And the inversion that David Davis describes in his book Inhuman Bondage is one where the tragedy of colonialism and slavery was inverted and projected onto black people, where they were made to be the cause of their own problems. The magic wand would have to go into that horrible historical mess and just begin to change the DNA of that. And I have no idea as to how to tell them how to begin to do that. For all that black people have been through, African people and people of African descent, including having to accept the fact of this creation of this thing called race that says that we're black, which is a huge part of the problem, we have to begin to change that, you know. As long as black people are perceived as less than or adversarial to the greater good, we're always going to have this problem. Yeah. And that's a very sad thing.
Afa Michael Weaver, it's a joy to listen to you, reading and thinking out loud, both.
Well, thank you. I don't often get a chance. I live alone, so I can't expound like this when I'm in the house by myself.
You can expound with us anytime.
Thank you.
Paul McCarthy recorded this conversation in the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ben Mandelkern edited it at the Watson Institute. I found Michael Weaver's reading resumes our series with poets we call Whose Words These Are. What our first score of poets confirmed is that they are still our unacknowledged legislators, as Shelley famously elected them. They're the ones you can trust, after all, to tell you that your coat is on fire or your country. Tomorrow, the poet Fred Marchant continues the conversation around Haiti. Post your own thoughts about Haiti and poets at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.